Salutations, Mets fans. Welcome to this week's edition of, for all you kids out there, a Mets Adjacent Baseball Prospectus Podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostra. With me once again this week is Jared Seidler. Jared, actually a fairly busy Mets news week, all in all, although they continue to just sort of meander on with a small lead over Atlanta. But we got a couple quotes I want your take on before we start. This is from Tyler Conklin on the narrative around the Jets. Everybody says same old shit. It's not the same old shit. We have a good team. And Robert Sala added, the Jets are keeping receipts on those that mock the team. I'm going to be more than happy to share them when it's all said and done. Does Robert Sala listen to this podcast, and are we on his list?
I doubt it. I mean,
your thoughts on the Jets opening week?
So, how about that Braves Phillies series?
It's always like, it's a weird time to record because we don't get like the break in. We were recording in the, like after the Sunday game or Sunday evening. We usually had better, more like recent Jets content. These quotes feel a little old, but I'm sure we'll get more quotes like that this week. So
this recording time is probably going to change in a couple of weeks anyway.
Sure. So, we might get more live look-ins on the New York Jets. I know people love that.
Make your fucking team better. Like, this goes for... I'm going to bring up the Todd Zeal Cabrian Hayes.
It's on my agenda, so I can check that off the list.
Can just throw that in.
Sure.
Kate tweeted something to this effect.
I've seen a lot of jokes about quiet quitting, which is, like, not... Yeah, so, I mean, they're funny, but...
Yeah. I'll cite my own fiance.
Sure.
The problem with the Pirates is not that Cabrian Hayes is not covering third and doesn't really seem to give a shit or whatever about covering third in that circumstance. The problem with the Pirates is that their owner and their team president and their general manager have made no attempt to compete in the last 5 years. Why the fuck should Cabrian Hayes?
Right. And look, it's not, I'm not going to say it's eyewash per se, because it's not eyewash.
Absolutely eyewash. There was not going to be a play at third base at the point where he was doing that.
And the thing about Cabrian Hayes is, if he's not the best defensive third baseman in baseball, it's only because Nolan Arenado and Matt Chapman are still really good. Machado, too. But he is an elite defensive third baseman.
Yeah, I mean, if you're the Pittsburgh Pirates and you're worried about Cabrian Hayes playing the game the right way,
Baseball media has often been worried about Cabrian Hayes playing the game the right way over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I can't imagine why. But you know what you got to do if you want Cabrian Hayes to play the game the right way? You got to tell him to lift the fucking ball. You got to do that with Odio Cruz, too.
Yeah.
Because you are failing your young talent because they are all hitting the ball in the fucking ground all the time.
He ended up signing the extension, right? After he got up. And given the fact they can't seem to get him to lift the ball, it's going to be a perfectly fine extension from Hayes' point of view. But, like, they basically held his major league time hostage to a pre-call-up extension and admitted as much in an Athletic article last summer, or summer of 2020.
Just good business.
Yeah. So, all right. If you've made it very clear that your business is not putting a good product on the field, or the best product you can on the field. So, This is what you get.
Yes, your team is, I don't even know how many games under.
A lot.
I'll be able to find that in a second. Your team is 36 games under 500. You should be concerned about a lot of things. Cabrian Hayes eating sunflower seeds during a play is just not fucking one of them. Like, it's just not.
I mean, to be fair, this is partially who I follow. I've seen more Mets people and, like, Gary, Keith, and Ron, even in last night's game, talking about it than Pirates people, but I also don't follow a lot of Pirates people, so.
Oh, Mark Madden was on it.
Oh, I'm sure Mark, I don't, Mark
Athletic
Madden.
Guy was on it. Yeah, you're just not.
Yeah, that's fine, but. Yeah, I mean, you're hitting, like, I like Rodolfo Castro. I liked him as a prospect. I thought he was a 4, maybe a 45. He's hitting third in this lineup.
Yeah,
now, I liked Cal Mitchell.
I thought he was a 4, maybe a 45. He might have 101 in A ball. And, like, it hasn't quite come together for him, right? He's just not going to make quite enough contact or hit for quite enough power.
Is another example of a guy where me and you overrated his hit toll because of the aesthetic quality of his swing without really looking at what kind of contact he was making.
Sure.
We would not do that now. Probably.
But, I mean, we figured it out, I think, by the time he got to Double A. And again, he's going to play in the majors for a bit. He's useful. He can play all three outfield positions, although, as we saw, he's fine. He's fine. But yeah, he's, again, he's been basically an everyday player for them, hitting in like sixth. They haven't really developed a pitcher in a fairly long time at this point. You know, Mitch Keller might, just by virtue of playing the Mets the last two times, get his ERA under 4 for the season, finally. Roansy Contreras, that's been a nice little season, but he had made that jump in the Yankee system before he was traded to the Pirates.
Their scouting is good, and their player development absolutely sucks.
Yeah. And, you know, like, Henry Davis and Nick Gonzalez have been hurt this year, so their system, I mean, obviously they graduated Cruz and Contreras.
I had somebody absolutely trash Henry Davis to me the other day.
Interesting.
Not a top 25 probably, like, absolutely trash.
Leover Peguero's like slugging .387 in Double A.
I wasn't even looking for that. I wasn't running down Pirate system. Yeah. It was just kind of general discussion about, like, some other prospect, and it was like, have you heard how bad Henry Davis has looked recently?
Yeah, he's going to be at the AFL, so I guess we'll... I mean, he's been hurt all year, too, so... Which, again, is its own problem, but...
Right, that's not, you know, he's a catcher who's getting hurt all the time and isn't really developing in the way that, like, say, Adley Rutschman was at the same time period.
Sure.
That's a problem.
Yeah, you know, so, looking at the rest of that grass craft, you know, Solamento's had a nice little full season debut. Lonnie White can't stay healthy. Bubba Chandler's been, like, okay.
The only gifts I see of Bubba Chandler are him fielding off the mound, which is a great sign.
And, like, you know, they had a high pick this year and took Tamar Johnson.
We're going to have to, based on the talent and the, quote, rules, unquote, that were set up for prospect rating, where we're not supposed to consider the organizational context in which they develop, because some guy that worked for the Blue Jays decided that we couldn't. Which, again, I think it's wrong, because we are going to rank this as the third or fourth or
whatever.
I was going to
say top five, probably, yeah.
And the five systems directly behind them are all substantially more likely to produce good major league talent because they can fucking develop players. The Cleveland Guardians are going to produce more good players out of their farm than the Pittsburgh Pirates, and we're going to have the Pirates higher on the organizational rankings, and I don't fucking know why.
Again, like, it's not like it's, you know, it's the Pirates. I mean, they're just never... They are doing exactly what everyone within the organization, I should say, wants them to do, at least within the high levels. So we've already seen this, right, with the Pirates, I think at all points in their respective rebuilds have had a better system than the Tigers, but they're going to run into the same problem in a couple of years, right?
Let's do a player comparison here.
All right, sure.
Let's say Henry Davis is going to be like 20th on the 101, right?
Sure.
Is Dalton Rushing going to make the 101?
I know I'm supposed to be doing my draft of it this week, but I don't think he's going to make mine. I don't know if he'll make it overall.
Right. He was, I think, the 40th overall pick. He plays the same positions.
Mm-hmm.
He hit...
He's probably less likely. He's probably less likely to catch than Davis, although it's not saying much.
He hit .424 with as many walks as strikeouts in full season ball after the draft.
Big major college. I know.
The Dodgers
major college player in Rancho, but yes.
Yes, but the Dodgers maximized every player of this type, and the Pirates have blown every player of this type. I think there's greater than 50% chance that Dalton Rushing is better player than Henry Davis in the majors.
Mm-hmm. That's not how prospect lists work, Jared. I mean, it sort of is,
why
but it also
isn't it?
You know, he's gonna get that reaction.
Yeah, I know. You keep that up.
I mean, if we think it's like if we were doing this, like the Dodgers would have like 14 guys on the 101. They'd have like Emmett Sheehan and Nick Nestrini and.
I don't know if Emmett Sheehan should, but yeah. Nick Nestrini should absolutely be on the 101.
I don't know if I had this conversation with you or Craig this week, but somebody pointed out Nick Nestrini's TrackMan is like the best TrackMan ever, basically. Analytically
and
speaking.
And I said his command was a three.
His command is, yeah, it might not even be
me.
A three.
No, it was Wait, me, it wasn't you.
It wasn't.
It was me, it wasn't Craig.
Okay. But like my point is, we didn't like, he was a fourth round pick and like Tyler Glasnow was a first round prep pick. But I wonder if we would have been saying this about Tyler Glasnow in 2016, right?
We did not rank Nick Nestrini, I don't even believe, on the long version of the Dodgers' top 10 last year. I'm going to look this up.
I had good reports on him in, like,
I'm making a very specific point. Yeah. I'm making a very specific point about how bad this all is.
Mm-hmm.
We put him behind Andre Jackson. We put him behind... We didn't even have him, to be clear. We ranked Andre Jackson on the Dodgers' top 10, but not him.
Andre Jackson's been good in the... I mean, he's barely playing, but he's a nice prospect.
Sure. I'm going to use my own fantasy league because I'm going to prove to people how much more information that I have that is not showing up in our product because we are not considering player development and type of player development.
Mm-hmm.
And this is bad. We should have this type of stuff that I didn't realize
Andre Jackson went to University of Utah.
Hold on, give me a second. I think I tweeted this at some point. I'm just going to search my own Twitter.
No, yes, you tweeted out. You tweet out your weird deep fantasy league prospect list a lot, so.
Alright, so.
We have a rare great radio moment with Jarrett searching stuff on the internet.
Here's what I did. Yeah. In NPL. Now, this draft was shortly after we put our lists out.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the players I drafted. I took Benny Montgomery at 24. That was a scramble pick because the guy I was targeting at 24 was Vinny Pasquantino, who went at 23.
Mm-hmm.
At 42, again, this is drafted prospects and some random odds and ends. At 42, I took Juan Yepez, who was a very good hitter in the majors this year when healthy, although he's kind of weirdly buried in that system. But that was kind of like a need type pick. At 49, I took Griff McGarry. Griff McGarry is going to be in our top 50 on the 101. At 50, I took Nick Nestrini, who was a fourth-round pick, who I took in the second round of this draft, who was probably going to be on the 101. At 72, I took Emmett Sheehan, who is going to be in consideration for the 101.
I don't think he's going to make, because he throws even less strikes than Nick Nestrini does.
Yeah, he had some weird injuries. I think there's a much higher relief profile there. Hmm. At 96, I took James Altman, who may make the 101. You might notice that those three picks are all Dodgers.
Yeah.
At 120, I took Adam Uller because I thought he was just going to get some innings.
He did get some innings. They weren't good, but yeah.
At 181, I took Bryce Miller, who's going to be in consideration for the 101. At 186, I took Mason Montgomery, who's probably going to make the 101. And at 198, I took Spencer Horwitz, who is not going to make the 101, but is probably one of the top 200 prospects in baseball. That's how much more information I had when picking my prep lists, just mostly undrafted players that year that we did not tell any of you because we couldn't, because I'm not allowed to say that the Dodgers have developed almost every single pitcher with Emmett Sheehan's profile, even though I fucking knew that. Even though I knew that just how strong Mason Montgomery's college TrackMan was, and realize that the Tampa Bay Rays were going to get him throwing the shit that he needed to throw, which his college pitchers didn't.
And now it's 171 strikeouts in 124 innings this year.
He's left-handed, too.
He is left-handed as well, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You're saying the Rays pitching development is better than Texas Tech's, Jarrett?
Will Warren,
mm-hmm.
We had a conversation
we did.
Before the season where I told you exactly what was going to happen. Will Warren doesn't have a good slider right now. I guarantee you it's going to be plus by the middle of the season. I had somebody tell me it was plus-plus the other week. Why are we writing this shit, man?
Because there are rules, Jarrett. We have to follow the rules.
Why?
I don't know.
Is there like some universal authority on prospect writing that's going to come down from the heavens and smite us? The fucking guy that would do that does it anyway!
It's true. Well, this is a good discussion for off-season list stuff, which is what we're starting right now. But this is Mets Adjacent Podcast, and there is some Mets news to cover. Sandy Alderson?
There are no Mets Adjacent prospects in this conversation, by the way.
Yeah, not really, no.
The only Mets adjacent prospect in this conversation is
Carson Seymour. Sandy Alderson has stepped down as team president, and the Mets are searching for a new team president. They have started interviewing, apparently, which is interesting. They're saying, or at least intimating, that they might not necessarily, like... So they're saying that
they may hire like a team sport business president from another sport.
They are saying the president of baseball operations position is vacant, but the team president job is a separate job from that.
And they could hire somebody who fills both spots, but may not. Yeah.
A little weird to me. I mean, it's not weird that Alderson's stepping down. We heard that for stepping up, whatever.
They're hiring a replacement for what Alderson has been doing the last 9 months, not a replacement for what he was doing in 2021.
Correct.
Theoretically,
yes. Now,
I'm not sure how much I believe any of this, but...
That's just, they're hiring a team president right now. It doesn't mean they couldn't also hire a president of baseball operations at some point this offseason when, say, David Stearns is available.
Yeah.
Right.
I also don't know if we're going to, you know, this could take a couple of months, too.
Right. Especially, like, the business side stuff, if that's what they're looking for, doesn't work on the same hiring cycle. It doesn't have to work on the same hiring cycle as the operation side stuff.
There are people that are interested in both. Alderson is one of them. Mark Shapiro is one of them. Theo Epstein is one of them.
Right.
So it would not be unprecedented for them to make a hire with baseball operations experience into an overall team president role.
Right.
Theo Epstein has specifically indicated that he's looking to get into that side of it. I will disclaim that I have not heard Theo Epstein's name connected to this year, but
right.
was connected to it at previous points.
Did he actually interview?
I believe out a statement saying he wasn't interested.
Yeah, that doesn't mean he didn't interview, but yeah. He didn't officially interview, I guess, whatever that means. So I made this point in the Discord, and I think it's broadly correct. I don't know how the rest of the Mets season's going to go. We'll get into that part of it in a little bit. But it would be a little weird to bring in a president of baseball operations over Epler, given how good they've been this year.
I'm not sure how good Epler's been, though.
Sure, there's that. I'm just saying the optics of it are a little weird, right? If you have you brought in a new GM, he theoretically has been mostly or completely running baseball ops from whenever he came in to...
I know
the present day, and the team's going to win 100 games.
I know.
So it's a little. We've always had like the David Stearns rumors and whatnot that they're buddies, and he'd be fine with Stearns coming in as president of baseball ops over him. I don't know how much there actually is to that, and if that's was ever true or if it's still true. You know, you could see a scenario where they kick. This would be a little weird given his background, but you could kick Epler up to POBO with some title inflation machinations, and one of his Angels buddies he brought in could be GM. You know.
You're usually either going to do that to hire somebody else's guy in a raise spot or
right.
raise up somebody who has GM interest.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I don't know how many people the Mets have in their the mid-tier of their front office are going to be getting GM interest from other teams.
Yeah. So, right, that this is always what happens with other the people the Mets are trying to hire, right, in other organizations.
The Mets got like four people GM titles.
Yes.
Over the last 2 years.
So I guess we'll see how this plays out. This is more of like a off-season story, and it's going to like we've noticed be an interesting off-season. You know, DeGrom's going to opt out. They've got to work out the Bassett contract. They've got to see what they're going to do with Nimmo and the outfield situation in general. They've got to figure out catcher. They've got to figure out the bullpen again. So it's going to be a fairly busy off-season for them, regardless of how well they finish and how far they get in the playoffs. So more on that to come. Speaking of the playoffs, there was an article, I believe, in the New York Post this week that noted if the Mets play the Blue Jays in the World Series, they might have several players unable to travel to Canada. Several star players, I believe, is the exact quote.
Yeah. They might.
They might.
I will say the same thing on this podcast, which I said on Twitter, which is that... how has nobody recorded these names?
There's the... Literally, I assume... This is me drawing some... possibly spurious conclusions. That the baseball media in general does not want to say boo about this stuff until the guys actually land on the restricted list.
Why?
I assume because of blowback from the organizations. Would be my general assumption. If you report on the Mets has not been vaccinated, it's it should be embarrassing for the organization. But it's also, it's a story for a week that they don't really want to deal with.
Okay.
And they can, you know,
no,
they can do things.
I understand why the organization would be embarrassed. I don't understand why.
And again, that guy's, how do you, like, also, I guess, how do you get it cold sourced that a guy hasn't been vaccinated? Without him saying, I have not been vaccinated. And they're, even the players that we might suspect aren't vaccinated or have been, you know, they have the... There's the players' union script they all say about this stuff.
I mean, so much more interesting to me than, look, I mean, we can say this about it. If it's, I believe Edwin Diaz was one of the players who was publicly vaccinated.
Yeah, I think it was Diaz, Castro, and Lindor,
correct.
And like Luis Rojas or something. Yeah. And Joey Lucchese.
Yeah, I may be wrong.
I think that was the group, but yeah.
Other than Edwin Diaz and Adam Ottavino, if there is an unvaccinated reliever, they're just not going to be on the ride. Like, it's not.
Sure.
You know, that just it is what it is. I don't even know, like, if you can replace the players for the three games just in Canada in that case.
Probably not. I mean, the other thing is, like...
The Mets are going to have home field over the Blue Jays. If it's a starting pitcher, they can start games 2 and 6, and it's not a huge deal.
I mean, it is, like, you don't know how the... Championship series is going to play out, though, is the thing, right? In terms of setting
you
your
can
rotation.
You can probably work the rotation schedule to where that
I mean, so what's actually going to happen is if the Blue Jays win their first playoff round, everybody's getting the shot on October 15th is what's actually happening.
If it is a starting position player, it's a big problem.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, I'll leave the poignant ... there.
I mean, we'll see how it plays out in the, I don't know if the Jays, so the interesting one is going to be the, if the Jays get home field advantage in the wild card round, because they have all three games there.
Yeah. I will repeat as I have previously that I think there's a pretty good chance that this mandate just goes away for the playoffs.
Yep. That might be, I mean, I don't, yeah, we'll see.
I will also, this is going to piss some people off. I don't really care. Look. How effective is a one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine mandate at preventing transmission at this point?
Right, sure.
Like, what are we doing here? Like, I, you know,
it's better than nothing.
Sure.
No, it's probably been. I believe it's still. I haven't read
the. Neither the league nor the federal government's involved, because it's both ways. It's not just Canada. They would not be able to re-enter the United States either, easily. I think they'd have to take a land crossing or whatever.
Yeah, I think somebody was using that to get around the.
Yeah.
I think it was hockey or something else, but.
Anyway. At some point, this vaccine mandate needs to either be rescinded or updated. I think that's probably the right way to put it.
That is probably the right way to put it.
Yeah. Because, the idea that you floated that they could get a one shot of the Johnson & Johnson during the NLDS and that would qualify for the vaccine, that's a little. I believe we already used the term eyewash earlier in this podcast.
Yeah. It's better than nothing for the player, especially, and for transmission.
Sure, of course. The players should have all gotten vaccinated a year and a half ago, and they should have gotten their updated boosters.
Yes.
And it was, the Players Association should have been pushing for vaccinations instead of been pushing for the rights of unvaccinated players. That was a policy mistake.
Mm-hmm.
By the Players Association, and I have no problem saying it, and lots of other people will have problems saying it, and some of them will even have problems with me saying it. So, that in my opinion was a mistake. MLB did not do a particularly good job promoting vaccination amongst its own players, and they're still feeling the consequences of that. But at the same time, the idea that could just get his shot on October 13th or whatever the date is, and this becomes a problem is, that's what Merrifield and Andrew Benintendi did too. And I don't know if that's what Mets players are going to do. There were comments made by certain Mets players whose vaccine status is unknown that indicated that if the New York vaccine mandate had held up, it wouldn't have been a problem.
Way to obscure who it was there, Jared.
Take whatever you want to take from that. I'm restating public comments.
Yes, you are.
One of those players was Pete Alonso, who also starred in a vaccine promotion commercial.
Yes.
So.
Anyway, as long as we're covering some fun reporting around the Mets, we got the, I don't even know what to call this. We got a SI article, I guess, sort of be from a lot of quotes based around Francisco Lindor, by saying the Mets organization isn't a shit show anymore.
Yeah, and then Steve Cohen trashed the article on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, because he was obviously still in charge last year, but I don't think it is a little weird to me that it's like I had less of a problem, I think, with the thumbs down stuff than you did, but it is a little weird for that to be coming from Lindor. I know he's the clubhouse leader, and that's fine, but it is a little weird for given the this was like a toxic organization last year, and now it isn't.
Yeah, like, buddy.
We also got the annual Mets players aren't happy with GKR.
Yeah.
Aside in there as well.
People were like really upset with that. That being put out there, and just like
they just had like this happens.
Yeah, this has
every
not
year.
Been an uncommon thing that happens.
Right. They're, I don't think it's
hard on the team, and they should be.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a. Again, it's not. I don't think it's like confrontations on the plane like we were getting 15 years ago, but I'm sure they grumble about it or whatever. And there's a comment of Buck turning the volume off in the clubhouse, which again, it's fine. Like Major League Baseball players are weird, and whatever they have to do to, to keep themselves on track over the course of a very long season, you just do. But again, I don't think I briefly listened to the Phillies broadcast on Friday night, and man, I have my choice between the Phillies and the Atlanta broadcast. I like the Phillies broadcast because it's actually better. I think both those broadcasts are better than the Marlins and the Nats, but it is kind of stark. They did the whole like when a Cunha hit the 2-run homer to put him ahead. They did the whole like just like silence in the.
Yes. I was also listening
to in the show. Booth, which I hate. Yeah, it was just a very unpleasant experience.
I do to watch. I mean, say in general, but one other thing from watching that broadcast, and you already know what I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
This game was in Atlanta.
Yeah,
I would say probably a dozen times a year, I unthinkingly turn on a big game in Atlanta, not a Mets game, another game.
Yeah.
And I am met with the stadium operations crew queuing up the lights, the audio cues, and the accompanying music for a chant that a Native American baseball player said was racist and asked them to stop doing 3 years ago.
Yep.
And they, at the time, said that they would reduce the queues and reduce its presence in the stadium experience, and when they came back from COVID, they ramped it up instead.
Yeah. I will point out, too, and that they, like...
They named a fucking party deck after it. There's signage all over the stadium, and they do it. I would call their current stadium experience defiant about that.
Sure.
And they are encouraging it as much as they possibly can.
And it's, I mean, it's unfortunate on a number of levels, but just from an aesthetic experience, they have, like, one of the cooler organists in Major League Baseball. Like, just let him do his thing. You don't need to... I mean, there's obviously no reason to embrace this whatsoever, but even from a... Yeah, I mean, it's frankly just mystifying to me that the league hasn't stepped in at this point. And I'm sure we'll have more of that to come in the playoffs, too.
Yeah.
Or even, like, yeah, we're gonna watch that last series, that last weekend, and I assume, you know, it's going to be, if not for the division outright, certainly... Very impactful on the...
Pointed out, and you got a bunch of...
Yeah, what else do I know?
You got a bunch of dudes that, you know, have trucker hats in their Twitter pictures, and their bio is Christian, patriot, father, brother, whatever. It's not racist, man. They got the... This one tribe said it wasn't racist, so it's not racist?
Yeah.
So we can't even talk about it because a lot of people hide from it, including Braves affiliated media, because they know there's no way to defend it. The worst people on Twitter defend it with bullshit that the teams put out, and it just keeps happening because the league doesn't seem to care either. And eventually, just like with the Washington football team, something will happen and it'll have to go away and they'll rename the team and get rid of the chant. And that's also true for the Kansas City Chiefs and the Florida State Seminoles and all the other places. But I don't tweet about the Florida State Seminoles football program doing the Tomahawk Chop because I don't fucking watch Florida State football games most of the time.
Yeah.
I got that one too. Well, you didn't tweet about this when the Chiefs game was going. Buddy, I didn't fucking watch the Chiefs game.
The Chiefs shouldn't do it either. There you go.
Yeah.
One last melancholy note before we head to the actual baseball games of the week. John Stearns passed away.
Yeah.
And I do think it was... this is, like, not the reason for Old Timers Day, but this is one of the reasons it's important, I think. You know, he did get to, I didn't know that his health was failing at the time, but they made it like he really wanted to get out there for...
That had, I think it had been out there that he was ill, but not serious. Right.
And yeah, it's, you know, it was nice for him to put the uniform on one more time and get back in the stadium and see guys he played with. And it's just like, I'm almost more, I know we had talked about whether they should do it yearly or not. They should probably just do it yearly.
Yeah, I mean, there's... Again, if you're going to do it properly yearly, it's fine. If you're going to turn it into a cheap gate attraction like the Yankees have done over the past couple of years, it's not fine.
Right.
So. But yeah, I mean, John Stearns was in, but before both of our times, yes. Obviously, but was
in the
excellent Met in some bad periods.
Right.
Was, except for one plate appearance with the Phillies, who he got traded from, was a career Met.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
made four All-Star games. Again, it was in an era where the Mets were not going to have multiple All-Stars.
He was the best catcher in franchise history before the Hundley and Piazza era.
Yes.
It's sad.
And obviously coached the team as well. Was a coach for a number of years, both for the Mets and around baseball as well.
Yeah, they seemed very well liked.
Mm-hmm.
Sad.
All right, it is 10 a.m. Mountain Time.
Yes.
12 noon on the East Coast. The Mets are heading into a final game of their four-game series with the Pirates. Jacob DeGrom on the mound facing Johan Oviedo, I believe. Mets going for the mop, in Cespedes barbecue terms, after getting swept by the Cubs.
which were almost an hour into this podcast, and we managed to not talk about the Mets getting swept by the Cubs.
Yeah,
because thanks God, because the discourse around this was just like fucking awful.
I mean, they did not play well.
Yeah.
It was not a fun series. The Cubs are pretty bad. Not as bad as the Pirates, but pretty bad.
So let's I'm going to do some maths here.
All right.
If you say that the Mets are 2-1 favorites in any individual games over the Cubs,
right,
which is probably roughly correct, although
the DeGrom line was something like -450,
yeah,
but
DeGrom line's much more than 2-1, but the other two games are less.
Sure.
For the purpose of discussing, if the Cubs have a 33% chance to win any individual game,
yeah,
and it's a three-game set, they're going to win about 4% of the time. A little under 4.
Like they're going to sweep 4% of the time.
They're going to sweep 3.6% of the time.
Yes.
The Mets, over the course of the season, are going to play 25 or 30 series against teams of roughly this quality.
Yeah.
And they're going, and by probability, they're likely to get swept by one of them.
Yes.
It doesn't mean the team is bad. They had some bad sequencing luck in those
they
games.
Did.
Both run sequencing and
You had the weird DeGrom. You had the weird DeGrom inning. Bassett give a couple home runs, which he'll do.
This shit happens. There was a lot of really terrible discourse that resulted from it.
Sure, there's been a lot of terrible discourse around the 100-win Mets.
As
yes.
we discussed.
Look,
yes,
it was like, here's the thing, right?
I don't think we need to do a full another.
If this sweep had been against, I don't know, the
Giants.
No, the Giants are probably a little too good. They had gotten swept by the Diamondbacks in Arizona or something. In, I don't even know when they played them. Oh, it was early in the season, like April.
Right,
nobody would have noticed, right? But because, the Braves lost 2 out of 3 to the Giants that week, the Mets really needed to win those games to get a little breathing room, because the schedule gets a little trickier after this.
They're still up by a game in the division, and they are still likely to have
The tiebreaker.
The tiebreak, yeah. Although not 100%.
Certainly. I mean, the other thing is, like, if they get swept in Atlanta, the tiebreak's probably, I mean, it might still be in play, but it's probably less likely to be in play.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter a whole lot at that point, certainly.
It is what it is. Of course, when they came out and, look, if they win today, which I know is, it's difficult. But again, Jacob DeGrom starting against the Pirates, they're starting basically a full-strength lineup.
They should
win this game. Okay. They'll have gone in this 16-game stretch 9-7.
Yeah.
Which is
not what you want.
It is
like one or two games worse than expectation.
Right. We said we wanted them to go 11-5 because 10-6 wouldn't feel great. 9-7 doesn't feel great either. And look, those are big games, right? If they win 11-5, they're three up, or at least three up.
Yeah.
And those are important games given they only have, 15 to play, 14 after today. That's a huge, it's probably a 25 to 30% swing in division odds.
I'm going to make a offshoot of the point I made last week.
Mm-hmm.
The two of us are trained to derive meaning from relatively small visual samples.
Yes.
Of baseball.
Yes.
There are things you can do in those samples. There are things you can't do. You have to know which one's which. But most of this is noise. Most of what you see over the course of a 3 or 4 game baseball series is noise. It's, you don't want to be, we always have this discussion and make this point, this exact point. How a player performs over that smallest sample is meaningless. It's how they look.
Yeah.
Those are two different things. He struck out 3 times does not mean anything. He had 3 uncompetitive at-bats, but...
You know, he chased a bad slider behind in the count every single time. Yeah.
I'm going to make a specific comparison point between two players, and this is going to piss half our listenership off, and I don't care. I've already pissed lots of people off. You probably won't hear half of it. Mark Vientos is taking uncompetitive at-bats. Darren Ruff is not.
Yeah.
Darren Ruff looks like a major league hitter going through a bad stretch. Mark Vientos looks completely overmatched. They're going to play Vientos anyway, and whatever, I don't care, it's fine.
Yeah, and that might change over the next 2 weeks anyway.
It's not that big of a deal. Nothing I have seen... Mark Vientos was running catastrophic whiff rates at AAA, and everything I have seen from him is, man, this guy really has no bat. This guy's like too bad to ball.
59% zone contact rate in the majors so far.
Yes, which is slightly lower, but not that much lower than his AAA zone contact rate. Yeah. I'm trying to get away, because the more I've been talking to team people for this year's lists, most of them don't look at the contact side. They actually look at the whiff side. Like, in your head, it's better. I know it's not how it's listed on Fangraphs, and that's why the public
when I get the TrackMan, I have to do the math. It's whiff in the zone.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. You don't want to think about it as contact. You want to think about it as whiffs.
So he swings and misses 41% of the time at pitches in the zone in the majors.
Yes. That gives you a... It also ends up being a matter of scale, right?
Yes.
So an average in zone whiff rate is around like 18 or 19%.
Exactly 18% this year.
Yeah. If you project that as zone contact, the difference between 65 and 81 doesn't seem as much as it is the difference between 19 and 35. It's a scale problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to look at that. It's whiff rate. Again, I know that's not how Fangraphs sorts it, and I know that's where everybody goes. That's where we go to get this information too. Savant actually does sort some of it by whiffs.
I mean, they have overall whiff, yes.
Yeah.
Which, if you're wondering, is 42% or 41.9. The MLB average is 24.7. This is 60 pitches, which is not a lot.
But that's also in the range where this starts.
It stabilizes fairly quickly as a stat, yes.
And also, am I allowed to say the exact number? Based on numbers we sourced, his zone whiff rate was in the high 30s in AAA. A player who has a zone.
I mean, I literally said what his zone contact rate was last week when you asked me, which I probably shouldn't have, but yes.
So you said 63, so we'll say 37. Yeah. A player with a 37% zone whiff rate in AAA, you would expect to be in the low 40s in the majors, because that is usually something that gets worse as you continue to go up levels.
Yeah.
It doesn't always. Sometimes the player gets better, sometimes the player makes adjustments, and I'll say this one flat out: if Mark Vientos continues to whiff 40% of the time in the zone, he is not going to be a major leaguer for very long.
Yeah.
So he is either going to get better at that, or he is not going to be in the majors.
He is getting uneven playing time, obviously, right now. He is hitting the ball very hard when he makes contact.
Yes. That has been the Mark Vientos.
Yeah. So the other thing is This could be because he's pressing. This could be because he's seeing better off-speed stuff. He is chasing more than he did in the minors. It's not a horrific chase rate.
That also usually happens.
Right.
Because, again, major league pitching much better than
yes.
AAA pitching. You don't see guys with Jacob deGrom shit except for when he's on rehab assignment. The yeah. difference between Jacob deGrom and Grayson Rodriguez is fucking huge.
Yes.
And Grayson Rodriguez is the AAA version of Jacob deGrom, mm-hmm. so... You know,
it's the difference between having sevens on the scout sheet and eights on the scout sheet.
Yeah. And it's not present sevens with Grayson either. It's
no.
seven projections. It's just not the same thing. We sometimes, you know, there are people that sometimes use that interchangeably, but it's not actually the same thing.
I think if you dropped Grayson Rodriguez in the majors, which the Orioles probably should have done already, he'd be like, what, a present number three starter probably?
Yeah, maybe a little better.
Yeah.
But. And there's a wide delta there, and
right.
just missed 4 months with injury.
So, yeah, it's true.
You know, I don't know. I advocated in an article about a month ago that they should try and get him ready as a reliever for this year. Now they've kind of fallen out of the race.
Yeah.
And, not totally out of the race. And his rehab has maybe been a touch slower than they'd hoped at the time, or at mm-hmm. least were publicly optimistic. That also is a nice reason to not call him up. And not start burning service time.
Yeah.
While we're on the topic of the Orioles, Gunnar Henderson looks like a fucking superstar, man.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Like now. Like, not like. I didn't use the word future there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just wanted to throw that one out there.
His zone whiff percentage is 14.5.
Yeah. Gunnar Henderson.
His chase rate is 17.6%. The major league average is 28.4.
I had somebody tell me this was right after I wrote my article. So yeah. This was not something that was out at the time. This was somebody with a team read my article and came to me. It wasn't one of the people I talked to for my article on him. So this would have been late June, early July. Somebody told me that their model, based on what he had done in 2022 up to date, had him as a top five swing decisions guy, not just in the minors, but in all affiliated baseball.
Right. I assume he's, you know, obviously he's swung and missed a little more in AAA, so it's
right.
possible the model.
But the swing decisions
yeah.
were not. Yes, the swing and miss is not.
He swings
swing
hard.
Decisions with him.
Yeah.
He's not a, yeah. It's not the decision.
Yeah.
It's the path of the swing.
Right. He's trying to lift.
The barrel control went from like bad to like above average,
yes.
but it's still not great. Which
yeah, this thing's like a this was it's less true this year. It was certainly true when I was drilling on him last year. It was like it's a little stiff, right? It's a little stiff power hitter swing at times. It's
yeah,
gotten
it's
better.
Not anymore,
yeah.
but it was in 2019 and even in 2021. The path was not great, and it's now good.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't expect him to run like, you know, Jeff McNeil level strikeout rates,
no,
but he'll be above average, right? I mean, he's striking out 19% of the time right now. I think that's probably
right.
in the general
This is
range,
also... But... And this is a point I've made. These skills work. These skills intermesh
yes.
together too. So, you know, once he's reached the level of swing decisions where he's laying off pitches in the because again the models for swing decisions that like teams are running out are not just chase rate.
Mm-hmm.
They want you to lay off or foul off good strikes too.
Shadow zone or whatever. Yeah.
Yes. Teams have much more involved analytic sets for swing decisions than just chase rate.
Right. Rob Orr has written about this some at BP, too.
Yeah. Yes, he has. Rob, in fact, is almost certainly going to message me either tomorrow or Tuesday and ask me what I was talking about here.
The most extreme example of this is, you know, Dan Vogelbach, right?
Yeah.
Who doesn't
ben
even
Clemens
swing at good strikes sometimes.
Ben Clemens has also written
yeah.
about this at Fangraphs several times. And I would encourage people to read both Rob's work on this and Ben's. Yes, that there are pitches are strikes that if you put in play, you're going to have below average outcomes on. And that is more important for hitters to avoid making that kind of bad contact than you would think. So yeah, that's Gunnar Henderson's really fucking good. I even went back at one point and looked at like our 2021 info on him, and I don't even think we were wrong, because like I remember we had people tell us we were wrong in 2020. There were like Orioles fans very mad that we didn't have
so the consideration
based on stuff that they were saying out of their.
He looked like completely overmatched the alternate site, and then when he was more age appropriate
experience at that time,
when he had more age appropriate competition instructs, both the visual and the statistical outputs looked better.
Yeah,
which fine. And I wrote that at the time, and I kind of middled it in the report for him, but I don't know what you want me to, to do at that point for a second round prep bat. That
let's roll back limited. Into the discussion that I have no idea how much of it you're going to actually.
Good lord, in. I'm not so probably not editing anything.
Okay, this might be completely out of context if it's not. Colby Mayo right now is at the exact same point that Henderson was at last.
Right.
Year.
I don't think you can very project similar... him making those that jump per se.
Well, I would not project him to make that jump.
Sure. But I liked Colby Mayo last year.
Yes. However, I am a lot more confident that Colby Mayo is going to make that jump
than Mark Vientos.
Mark Vientos is a demonstrably. I was going to try and find a prospect that's actually of like roughly similar. I can come up with one that's going to really be spicy. I am much more confident that Colby Mayo is going to make that jump than Jordan Lawler.
Sure.
Jordan Lawler is a better prospect. Jordan Lawler will be higher on the 101. Yeah. They will both be on it. Show me where the Diamondbacks hitters with questionable swing decisions have improved substantially on them. Give me a name.
I guess Christian Walker would be the...
Yeah. Okay, that's... Yeah,
no time.
Yeah, if that's where you're going with this, I know. My point has been proved, right? Like they've had an awful lot of good hitting prospects and not a lot of good major league hitters developing out of them.
Right. Pavin Smith really hasn't gotten there. Carroll's looked pretty good in the majors, in all honesty.
Yeah,
a little bit better than I expected.
Much better prospect than Jordan Lawler,
yeah.
too.
But yeah, I mean, he's hitting .275 and striking out a quarter of the time, which is about where I would have.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah. Again, he's a nice prospect.
I think Corbin Carroll's gonna. We are submitting individual lists. We're doing this as part of our process this year. So I am working on an individual list, and I am leaning towards putting Carroll number two.
Yeah, he's gonna be in the top three or four for both of us. I suspect.
Yeah. I basically have number two narrowed down to him or Jackson Chourio.
Oh, my lord. All right, well,
You're going to be way out of the rest
we'll
of our
deal
staff.
With that. Every
other individual list is going to come up with Jackson Chourio in, like, the top five or six. I'm warning you of this in advance.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
For all the shit you've given me for years about pretty swings without good underlying metrics, now all of a sudden...
He's 18 in double A.
Yeah.
He torched low A and was well above average at high A.
I'm aware of this, Jared. I have followed Jackson Chourio's career.
Some of his metrics are actually very good, and when you adjust them for age relative to lead, incredible.
He's
I'm
a
not
very
doing this
good
based
prospect.
On the prettiness of his swing. I'm doing this based on the fact that he's the third 18-year-old regular in double A in the last 15 years, and the other two were Bryce Harper and Fernando Tatis.
Speaking of prospects not as good as Jackson Chourio, the Mets AFL roster is out.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. The Mets do not care about the Arizona Fall League. They continue to not care about the Arizona Fall League. I guess they're also in a weird spot. Like, I don't know who they would send to the AFL. Beatty, I guess, would be one if they wanted to get him somewhere
back. He's got to at least be on the postseason taxi squad.
Yeah, so I guess that's not really...
I mean, they should really be signing Ronnie Mauricio there again, just because
He had a plate of
full I know why season. They're not going to.
Ziegler was a little weird to me, given the time he missed, but I don't know if you also want
that's gonna
Kelvin that Ziegler pitching that would in Arizona.
Be ugly if they sent him there, yeah. I would.
I don't think there's any developmental, but like that's the thing, right? There isn't actually any developmental value to the AFL.
Of course there is.
I mean, in most cases, it's fine for replacing lost reps. For hitters, they're also like, I looked up the pitching. I don't think the roster.
There's a lot more advanced technology in those stadiums than there is even in some of the team complexes.
I guess.
You're asking for developmental reasons. That's a developmental reason. That is a reason I have heard teams use to say this, you know, that
you're going to have. Do they really have more there than they would have at their own facility for, like, instructs and stuff like that? And they're not going to get.
Like, smart, good teams, but.
And there's, like, less one on one. Instructional time too, because you're playing games every day, but yeah, and with like other teams' coaches, like it's a very weird
thing. But the other team's coaches isn't necessarily a bad thing,
sure, I guess. But yeah, so the Mets sent like Mike Vassell is the best prospect, they say, either Vassell or Consuegra.
Yeah, Consuegra's on the taxi squad, which is odd.
Yeah,
I assume they just didn't have a Mets outfield slot for him, right? But that means he's only gonna play a couple times a week.
Whatever.
Vassell got overrated because the Mets were really happy that.
And look, he's they got a big way above. This stuff is probably better than your median eighth round pick.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice. He's probably
courtesy,
like
he was. I saw him, and he was a courtesy four for me.
The video done, stuff I've done since he's been back is a little better than that, but he's probably just a four for me.
Right. I'm not saying that he's not a good prospect. Yeah. I'm not saying that he wasn't a good eighth-round pick. He was not a better prospect than Carson Seymour. I'm not sure he's a better prospect than Junior Santos.
I probably put him ahead of Junior Santos, but yeah. I don't know that I put him ahead of, like, Joel Diaz and Leylon Obales, but
yeah, well, I mean, you have to make decisions on that.
I do, and you'll find out what those were in a month or so.
2 months.
Couple months. It's only September 18th. I got time.
Are we doing the Mets first this year?
I don't know if they'll be first. They'll be early.
Yeah, those were obviously. What schedule are we actually using?
It's going to be the same as last year. I'm going to figure it out as stuff comes in. All right. I figure we should take a break now, so we've already done an hour, which has been rarity in the first half, even though we didn't have much to talk about. But as always, Jarrett's found ways to fill time. It'll probably be almost an hour when it comes to you, too. But for now, we'll take a break and come back and do the third half of the show. Welcome back. Now it's time for the third half of the show. Before we do the third half of the show, we do housekeeping. This is For All You Kids Out There, episode 364. For All You Kids Out There is a Mets Adjacent Baseball Prospectus podcast. You can find us on the internet at baseballprospectus.com. The podcast is on iTunes and various other non-iOS apps. Just search for All You Kids Out There and you can listen or subscribe right there. I encourage you to do both. I also encourage you to rate and review the podcast. If you want to get in contact with the show or on Twitter at For All You Kids, Jarrett's on Twitter at J.A. Seidler. I'm on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. A Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/forallyoukidsoutthere. And you can email the show at allyoukids@baseballprospectus.com. We have a question from Andrew via email. Salutations, fellas. Quick question. Are most good relievers just failed starters? How difficult is it to become a good reliever? Are there relievers that are trained just to be relievers from the lower minor leagues? Any examples? So it used to be that pretty much the best relievers in baseball were drafted and developed as starters up until at least like double A.
Yes.
I wrote about this for BP, I don't know. Probably like 2017 or 2018. I had a longer piece, something relating to reliever
It's
development.
becoming less true, like
Becoming
very
less true
rapidly.
now. Like reliever specialization has like drifted down into the college ranks too. I mean, the most notable one is like every college team has like two low arm slot pitchers, like usually a righty and a lefty that can throw 90. And like major league or minor league, I should say, bullpens usually have multiple of those as well. Everyone's throwing harder. You look at the, we'll use the Mets system as an example, right? It's highly possible that Mike Vassell will end up being a one re inning reliever. And I would expect he's going to start up until Double A. We've ranked Eric Orsi last year, and he might make the list this year despite his injury issues. And he's been a reliever pretty much since college. So you do see it. It used to be, and I think still is probably to the case, that your best high-end relievers are starters, at least like in A ball, certainly in college. But that's becoming less true too. It's also easier, I'd say easier, but you see more. So it used to be the old rule was you take a starter that's at like low 90s with a flash plus slider, you move with the pen, and suddenly it was 94 to 96 with a plus slider, right? It's more complicated than that, but that was sort of the shorthand for what you're getting in the bullpen. Now you can take relievers that are in the low 90s with a flash plus slider, and through high speed video and data outputs, you can, or weighted ball training or any other number of developmental tools, get the same result. So you're just seeing more developmental successes with relievers, I think. And I think teams care about that more too, as relievers start throwing more and more innings. You're searching for, those developmental wins, just, and you're going to go through, as weird as it is to say, you're going to go through more relievers, especially the more analytically inclined teams. Like we've talked about how the Rays just wear out bullpen arms. So they need to be able to and because of the way they run their pitching set, they need to be able to constantly find more bullpen arms as well. And they're not really doing converted starters. They're finding relievers that do one or two things well and maximizing what they get out of them. So that is, I think that's the only email for this week. Did we answer? So, yeah, we answered that. Phil question from Phil's was answered last week. Do we have stuff in the Facebook group? I just wanted to. I think we might have had. I know we missed a question last week that I want to catch up on, and it was a Vientos question, so we might have actually already answered it in the Vientos discussion.
It's always good to talk about marketing and post more.
Well, actually, this is a. Yeah, he didn't really answer this. From Charles, Q for the P. With Vientos bringing the number of first base DH only players to four, any chance they would have any of them play another position? Jarrett said before, the real place to hide a bad fielder is second base. Would one of the three be even playable there? Also, I've been wondering since the trade deadline why they went with Ruff instead of old friend Wilmer. Please speculate and answer because I don't have one.
Does he cost more?
He probably costs more, and it seems like the. I mean, the Giants just extended Flores on a 2+1. So it sounds like they wanted to keep him. So, he's younger. He's, I don't know if he's a, he's probably a better hitter overall and has been better against righties than Ruff in recent years. So, yeah, it probably would have cost more. I don't know if they would have gotten Flores for the same package. As weird as that is to say. Obviously, Ruff had the, what you would have called cheap control, but now is guaranteed money, I guess.
Decision they made.
I would not play any of these. You've joked about playing Pete Alonso at second base, I think, at some point
Yeah.
over the last couple months.
That sounds like something I would have done.
Yeah. You could try Vientos there. This is one of those things that's going to become functionally impossible with the shift changes, I think. Because you'd want to
Yeah.
play him
Yeah.
like in the outfield grass because he can't, he's not going to be rangy enough there, but he has a pretty strong arm. And if you got to play him on the dirt, he's got to move. That's, it's going to be difficult to cover for these kind of players' defensive flaws going forward. I think you'll see this with the Cardinals and Nolan Gorman as well. I'll be interesting to see what the Twins do with Jose Miranda, who I think is a player he's not very good defensively at a number of spots, and you're going to want to position him to take advantage of what he does offer you. I guess he's only played first and third for them. He played some second, even some short and corner outfield in the minors. But I also think some of the shift stuff's overblown, because it really just takes away planning your whoever you want, your second baseman, your third baseman in short right field.
Problem.
Yeah. But it does, for these like edge cases, I would consider playing Mark Vientos at second base an extreme edge case. I think it does affect that. Q for the P from Sean. Why do the Mets hate Jeff McNeil? Just when I thought they stumbled upon giving one of your best hitters more at-bats by hitting him third, they're now hitting rough ahead of him. I know they know that Jeff hits lefties fine, so why?
Well, no, they don't know that.
Their lineup generating machine does not know that, apparently.
Yeah, so the Jeff McNeil...
Apparently he likes hitting eighth, but I think...
I mean, I would say... Regarding Jeff McNeil and his lineup spot against lefties, he has almost no power against lefties, and he really never has.
He does have a left-handed split, right? It's not that you can't play him against lefties. His career batting average against him is .291, and he gets on base at a .357 clip.
Yes.
But you're going to prioritize your right side, your righty hitting platoon power guys in that situation.
Yes, that's a good way to
put it. I mean, even this year, his lefty split this year is very much in line with his career numbers. He's had seasons where he's hit lefties better. He's had seasons where he hit lefties worse, which, again, you're talking about 100 to 200 plate appearance samples in any given season. So it is going to be variant. He probably shouldn't hit eighth against lefties. He probably should hit, like, second against lefties, because it's at the OBP. But I could see a lineup optimization tool spitting that out.
Yes, I could too.
It would help if they did not have a double play machine hitting behind him, whoever it is, in the ninth spot. But
yes.
Whichever catcher it is.
Again, when you say they know that, you have to
specify
who they is.
That's right.
A little more complicated.
I do not think Buck is making... I'd say Buck, I think, has input in the lineups based on who needs a day off or whatever else. They might even have, like, a load management model for these guys.
My understanding is that the Mets have been a model-driven lineup team for...
A bit.
A number of years.
Yeah.
A bit. That's a good way to put it.
And again, we should point out that this kind of lineup optimization stuff, like even over the course of a season, is only worth a few runs. Yep. You know, there is reason to, in a three batter minimum league, actually now alternate righties and lefties more.
Yes.
So it does get, you can get really, really granular with this kind of stuff. You can consider opposing bullpen, how long the opposing starter is likely to go, you can try to model what the team's bullpen usage is going to be based on how they've used, or your opposing team's bullpen usage is going to be based on how they've, you know, who's been used a lot recently and how they generally load manage their bullpen. So you can get, it's going to go way beyond, you know, Jeff McNeil hits lefties fine, right? It should too. Like, you know, what kind of lefties does he hit fine? What kind of righties does he hit fine? But there's also an argument for having a fairly stable lineup for, again, it's going to depend on your locker room in a lot of cases, you know, and how comfortable guys are moving up and down the lineup. Obviously McNeil's hit all over this year. Well, generally speaking, you know, Nimmo and Lindor and Marte have been fairly steady in those top three spots. So that covers the Facebook group. And that covers the correspondence. I don't think there's a ton of wrestling. The Arthur Ashe Stadium show is this week for AEW. Card looks great.
It does, but also not in a way that really drove me to get last minute tickets. I'm not going to the show.
Yeah, like, it's also it's a very long night of wrestling for you.
Yes.
Because they're doing a two-hour rampage on the back of it. Yeah, they're doing another battle royal for a title shot, even though MJF just won a ladder match for a world title shot. So it sounds like they want to do
a WWE trope where you just do constant multi-man matches for title shots instead of actually bothering to build anybody up for a title shot.
Right. So, yeah, whatever. The MJF thing was an angle. You can do an angle. I'm sure they know who is going to win said battle royale on Rampage. You can just have that guy win some matches for a few weeks in featured spots on...
It's the third one of these in like 2.5 months. Yeah. Because they did the one for the Brody King title shot, too.
Yes. Brady noted to me they've kind of gotten rid of the rankings. Which is fine.
I don't know if that's permanent or just something...
Kind of a mess given the current title situations, yes.
Yeah.
I expect Moxley, Danielson will be excellent. I expect the tag team title match will be excellent. You know, Orange Cassidy and Pac. It's a really good card.
It is.
I'm sure it'll be a good show. They did a very big number for what was kind of a random Dynamite, I guess, this week.
Yeah, I mean, Jericho Danielson's a
significant
match.
Yep.
Yeah, this is not a product I find particularly interesting or compelling right now. Yeah. Brady's going to yell at me as he does.
You're not into Luigi Primo?
No. I mean, it's just they've got a lot of problems and they don't really seem to be fixing a lot of problems that they have, and life goes on, right?
Yeah, life goes on. Who do you think's winning, Danielson Moxley? I could see arguments either way.
I mean, if we're taking the TV at face value, they've been building Moxley to win the title. I think pretty obviously.
Yeah.
In like a lot of companies, that would mean it's actually going the other way, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the case here.
I don't know. It's weird because having Moxley, this is obviously the out and out title. So it feels like they've been hot potatoing it, even though they haven't intended it to, obviously. It's just been circumstantial. And it just it does kind of feel like Moxley needs this win in a long run.
Yeah, but at the same time, you also just had him get beat by the guy who's not around anymore.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And if Danielson is champion...
I think that's fine.
It is. It feels fresh.
He really
fresh.
Hasn't been pushed at that level.
He hasn't been. You know, he was dropping falls to, Daniel Garcia. Which, again, is fine. Like, that's a match you can go back to for the title now. I know that he won the...
Sure.
Rematch, but you probably have fresher matches with Danielson on top.
Do you?
Yeah, I mean, again, Mox has kind of been, Mox had a title run already. He's
still got an Adam Page. He got an easy Adam Page program that they've built up and never went to.
Yeah. I mean, they also just had Page lose to Danielson in the quarterfinals of this, but
yeah.
I don't know why they booked that match, but
I think it's definitely a
match you can go back to at some point, but it seemed weird to do it at that point.
Right, there's a lot of, just weird booking decisions lately, things that they didn't need to back themselves into, which they then back themselves into.
I suspect Paige is, getting eliminated from the Battle Royal through, Dark Order miscommunication or something.
I don't even know. It's hard to... I don't know what they're doing with Paige at this point.
Yeah, fair enough.
Other than booking him poorly.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's an intentional de-emphasis because of all the
yeah
stuff going on. It would not surprise me, certainly. Would certainly make a lot of sense. Like, but yeah, I don't know.
Who would you have win the Battle Royal? Leave it on that, I guess.
Jungle Boy.
Interesting.
They need to make somebody. It's
yeah.
It's
see, I would.
A
I think I would have.
Group of names at the top.
I would have Leon Swerve drop the title in what I assume will be a really good match, and I have Keith Lee win the Battle Royal.
Yeah, that's.
Lee Moxley is fresh. It'll be a good match.
Yeah, no,
it gets no. Lee on that level, which is probably where he should be. You could do the same thing with Swerve, too, honestly. I just think Lee and Moxley is a more interesting TV match for Moxley. But
yeah, I'm not...
Lee feels like the bigger star. It's weird. I think Swerve should be the bigger star on that team, but it feels like the crowd's more into Lee. I think it should be one of them, basically, if you're going to get the tag team titles off them, which they should.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah. Do we have anything else?
I don't think so.
Do you make anything of, like, Kenny Omega being pictured with Kota Ibushi on his suspension / vacation?
I mean... Kenny Omega, man.
He is Kenny Omega. We never actually talked about the Kenny Omega, I wouldn't hire 80% of you quote.
Yeah, I mean, that came out this past week.
Yeah, well, like, it's not a particular surprise to me that Omega would prefer, like, DDT, Dragon Gate, and various Joshi wrestlers, Ice Ribbon people on these shows than...
He has claimed that was a joke.
All right. Omega, well known for his sense of humor. Yeah. Yeah, as we said, nobody comes out looking great from all of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah. They certainly don't. And I don't know what you can do about that, really.
I mean, you can just put the title on Mox and the Acclaimed and push Wardlow more and try to just keep on keeping on.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what they're going to do.
Yeah, it might work. I mean, that is the one thing of, like, they have to have a plan, but this promotion can be fine without Punk, Omega, and the Bucks. They have guys they can heat up that the audience will buy into. We got plenty of them. That's one of, part of the problem is they have, like, almost too many guys worth pushing at this level. I haven't really been able to do it with any of them, but or at least enough of them, I guess. But we'll see how that goes. And we'll see how the Mets' next road trip fares. I'm sure we'll be having the same conversation. There's still one up on the Braves or whatever.
Hopefully
it'll be more. But either way, we'll talk about it next week on another edition of For All You Kids Out There.